Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much. Let me just clip this on. Thank you so much for coming and for encouraging us with your presence. It's a real delight to be here. We had a pleasant journey down, although the sat-nav took us to a completely different place than we should have been. We're getting way too used to trusting these sat-navs. And not actually doing some map work of actually figuring out where we're meant to be. We just plug these things into our phones and just go. But it's a real delight to be with you. What I want to do over the course of this first session, this is going to be like a tag team wrestling match this morning, although hopefully not as brutal. I'm going to spend about 20 minutes just opening up some thoughts on what apologetics actually is from the New Testament mindset. And I think it's important that we just set the stage for that, because this is an important word. It's a word that a lot of us maybe don't understand. It's a word that some of us think we understand. What I want to do is just get right down to basics and just say, when the New Testament uses this word, what are we actually talking about? And then Marie's going to come and she's going to talk a little bit about culture and about how to engage with people's questions. Does that sound like a plan? Are you well fed?
Yes.
Good. I'm thoroughly envious. But let's get started. I want to begin with a short story that comes from my time in school. As Marie says, I'm from Northern Ireland, and I went to a school in Belfast. Now, my school in Belfast was called the Royal Belfast Academic Institution. It sounds very, very extravagant. It was, it's nowhere near as prestigious as it sounds. And I think my parents only went there because, judging by how I conducted myself as a child, they felt that the only fitting place for me in my teenage years was an institution. So that's why they put me there. Within the second year of my time there, we had open day every single year. Now, I don't know how open day works in some of the schools that you might be familiar with, but in my school, open day was that day where we opened the school to potential pupils and to their parents to come. And basically what you did was you made the school look like Disneyland to a 10 or 11-year-old potential Belfast student. And so we brought out all the great things, all the really attractive things, all the exciting things that made this school look like the place that you would want to send your young son to ensure the brilliance of his future education and ensure a holistic and exciting education. Now, you never saw those things when you actually started the school, but you brought them out for open day in order to attract people in. And one of the things, there was all kinds of different displays going on, and one of the things that they did was they would get pupils to man the various displays. And I was asked on this occasion, I was only 13 or so, to man the physics display. Now, I didn't really like physics, but I was asked to do it, and at that stage you just do what you're told. And I wasn't in detention that Saturday, so I was actually available. So I manned the physics display, and what I had to display for people who would come along and just walk into the classroom and have a look was that particular experiment where you have a beaker of water and a needle, and if you put the needle into the beaker of water and you just drop it vertically, the thing drops to the bottom of the glass beaker. But if you put it on carefully and horizontally, it actually floats. And this is actually due to surface tension on the water. Now, here's the thing. I didn't actually know that was the explanation. So I just thought this was a great magic trick, and here I was enjoying myself, just all of these potential pupils coming in, and I was bedazzling them with my particular magic trick, and it was going really well. I think I single-handedly recruited probably 10 future pupils for the school. Just wanted to give back, and it's a joy to do that. But then came the 11th pupil, and I did my magic trick. And for some reason, this 11th pupil did what I never expected him to do and what no one told me he would do. He said this: "Why does it do that?" And I didn't know. And you would think that the person that they asked to man the physics experiment should actually know the physics behind the experiment that are actually manning. So I did what any self-respecting Irishman would do. I said the first thing that came into my head. And I said, well, I thought about floating, and I thought about why do things float on water, and I thought about first year physics and icebergs and things like that. And so I said, oh, it's about density. Yes, it's due to density. Now, of course, that's the most stupid thing you could say, because, of course, it wasn't about density whatsoever. And he didn't buy it at all. And as convincing as I tried to be, he looked back at me. And this is no word of a joke. He spoke for about the next 2 minutes, explaining in the finest physics detail of exactly what was going on as to why this particular needle floated on the surface of the water. And I stood there, a little shell-shocked, having just been scientifically punked by a 10-year-old. And I braced myself, and I looked at him stern in the face, and I smiled, and I said, no, it's density. Definitely density. And he walked away thoroughly unimpressed, and I don't think he came to the school. Now, the next time that something like that happened to me was when people asked me why I was a Christian and to give a reason for why I was a Christian. I'd become a Christian at 16, and for me it was very much about an experience with Jesus Christ. But what I discovered was that there were many people who weren't Christians, and they didn't have that kind of experience, and so they wanted to know not just what my experience was or how I became a Christian, but reasons why I was a Christian. And in fact, what they were actually asking me to do was apologetics. And I didn't have much of an answer for them beyond my own particular story. Now, I do now, and I'm sure you'll be pleased to know that I do, otherwise why am I here? But we live in a culture that is increasingly post-Christian. And because of that, they're asking questions about the validity of Christianity, about reasons for why it's true. And that brings us to the issue of apologetics, because as different as this culture is from maybe English culture maybe 50 years ago, certainly 100 years ago, that is actually the kind of culture that Christianity began in. Christianity did not begin in a culture where everybody knew what Christianity was, everybody understood its terms, and everybody accepted it as valid. It grew out of a melting pot of all kinds of different ideologies and ideas. And when the Christian claims came into the public arena, it raised questions for people about on what basis that could be true. And so one of the important things for Christians was to learn to give reasons for the faith and for the hope that they had. And the classic text for this, for any apologetics, I'm sure you may have heard this, is in 1 Peter 3:15, where Peter says to a group of churches that he's writing to, but in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. And then he says this, always being prepared to make a defense, to give a reason, some versions might say, to anyone who asks you for the hope that is within you, and yet do it with gentleness and respect. Now that term, give a defense or give a reason, is the Greek term apologia, from which we get our term apologetics. In other words, what Peter is saying is, you Christians, always be ready to give an apology for the faith or for the hope that you have. Now, this word apologia, or this word apologetics, is a really unfortunate word for two reasons. One is because any time we talk about giving an apology in our culture today, most people think we are saying sorry. So we're, you know, it sounds like we're saying, oh, well, I am a Christian apologist. In other words, my full-time job is to go and tell people about Jesus Christ, but I'm really, really sorry about it. It's not my fault. It's God's fault. He called me to do it. But I'm really, really sorry. Whereas actually the classical idea of giving an apology, the way that the original audience would have heard this, was more in the sense of giving a legal defense. So it would assume that there would have been certain accusations, perhaps certain misrepresentations that would have been branded against Christians or the Christian faith. For example, in the later chapters of Acts, when Paul is accused of being an instigator of civil unrest, when he's accused of defiling the temple by bringing Gentiles into certain courts of the temple that they weren't allowed, Paul stands before them and says, "Let me give my defense. Let me give my apologia, my apology. Let me give you reasons and explanations for why this representation of me and what I've done is not true." So it's not about apologizing. It's about giving a reasoned defense in the face of misrepresentation or certain accusations. The second thing is this. The word apologetics is not a translated word. It's not that we have used the word apologia and translated it into an English word, for example, reasoned or defense. We have transliterated the word. In other words, we have just taken a Greek word and made it an English word. And that becomes problematic for a number of reasons. Because we're not familiar necessarily with a word like apologetics. When someone comes along and says, "Oh, I'm into Christian apologetics," or when someone comes along and says, "I am a Christian apologist," it makes apologetics sound like a very specialized discipline, a very unique, something, you know, that's akin to a subsection of theology or a subsection of philosophy, something that only certain people can do, evangelism or something that only very intellectual Christians can engage with, but not something for every Christian. And I used to have, I think sometimes the way we practice our apologetics, or the kind of practice that we do that goes under the rubric of apologetics, doesn't actually help that. Because often what we do, what we practice as apologetics is these high intellectual debates. Or these events where we take on very, very intellectual and difficult questions, and we have people who have more degrees in the thermometer and studied at the greatest universities and take on the likes of Richard Dawkins and things like that. And we say, that's Christian apologetics. And that used to happen to me because when I grew up, the church that I was part of in Northern Ireland is run by John Lennox's brother. And we would have Professor John Lennox come and we would have him do apologetics and give. And I was really glad that Christian apologists exist. I was really glad that there were people who were intelligent who could answer these questions. I was wild. I would come and I would listen to John. But here's the thing. I didn't think for one second that I could do it. I didn't think that if that is Christian apologetics, that it was at all for me, because I didn't think I had the genetics to do Christian apologetics. I just wasn't that smart. Now, here's the problem with that kind of thinking. Peter is writing to the whole church. He's writing to all Christians. And he's commanding them, you be ready to give your apologetic for the hope that you have. Now, what happens if Peter commands us all as Christians to be giving Christian apologetics, and yet Christian apologetics is something only for special Christians, only a specialized discipline? There's a problem there if God commands us to do Christian apologetics, and yet the vast majority of us don't have the genetics to do it. Either God is extremely cruel, or we need to redefine what we mean by Christian apologetics. And so, for the remaining 8 minutes that I have, I just want to spend a few moments just in 1 Peter 3 and ask, when Peter says, always be ready to give an apologetic, what does he actually mean? Because here's the thing. If you had walked around in the first century among the Christians and said, I am a Christian apologist, no one would have known what you meant. Because Christian, the term Christian apologist was not a term that was employed. There was giving an apologetic, but this sort of professionalized term that's used for sort of highly intellectual Christians was not something that the early Christians would have been aware of. And I think that's exactly what Peter's getting at here when he writes to the whole church. This is a letter to the whole church. It's a letter to the church that is suffering, but it's not a letter just about Christian apologetics. It's a letter about how to live for Christ in a world that is often hostile to him. Because those, that's the kind of world and that's the kind of dynamic in which Christian apologetics expresses itself. And so Peter writes, just before this verse 15, in verse 14, Peter says this, even if you should suffer for doing what is right. So these Christians are suffering. He says this, have no fear of them, nor be troubled. Now, one of the greatest obstacles to us being public and confident about our faith today is fear. And Peter understands this. The fear of looking stupid. The fear of people saying to us, oh, you're a Christian. I thought you were intelligent. And there are sound bites and big ideas going around in culture that if you are a Christian, you have to turn your brain off. That faith is blind belief. It's not anything that could be connected with rational thinking and serious thinking and intelligence and things like that. And that intimidates people. And it intimidates people into silence. And so as much as our culture might be an intellectual intimidation, the culture that Peter is writing to was a physical intimidation. These people could very literally suffer for public obedience and public expression to Jesus Christ. And yet Peter says, do not be afraid. Now that sounds rather harsh in some ways, isn't it? Because fear resides in the heart. How can you command people to not be afraid? Is it not legitimate to be afraid? Or are there means that Peter encourages in us that will actually help us to not be afraid, to gain more confidence? Because fear is a dynamic thing. Fear can grow from outside pressure, but fear can also be mitigated by internal confidence. And that's where he goes next, because Peter then says, but in your hearts, same place where fear resides. Fear resides in hearts, but here's what Peter says. The way that you mitigate that kind of fear is in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Set apart Christ as Lord in your heart. In other words, the basis for effective Christian apologetics is Christian discipleship. We often get asked when we are part of our team and people enjoy what our team do and things like that. People often say to us, I would love to do what you guys do, but where do I start? What kind of books do I read? You know, do I need to go and do a particular degree? And do I need to, what philosophy books can you recommend? And that's fine. There is a place for that. But Peter says the basis for effective Christian apologetics is to have a heart, not just a mind, but a heart that is absolutely convinced of the lordship of Christ. It's Christian discipleship. And I would just ask you, are you convinced that Jesus Christ is Lord? Because that is the starting point. That is what gives us the confidence to go in and be public with our faith. Because if Jesus Christ really is Lord, then he's not just Lord of our private Christian experience. He's the Lord of the whole universe. So what he then says is this, always then be prepared. With that as a basis, and we could unpack that, but we don't have time. With that as a basis, always be prepared to give this apologetic, to give this reason for the hope that you have. And this word prepared is an interesting word. It's the same word that the gospel uses when Jesus says this, be ready or be prepared, for the Son of Man comes at an hour that you don't know. In other words, what he's saying is this, there is an event that is guaranteed to come, the return of the Son of Man. And that's what we do know. But what we don't know is the timing. We don't know when it will come. We don't know how it will come. And so the challenge, therefore, is for us to live in a consistent state of preparedness, a consistent state of everyday readiness for that event. And that's exactly what Peter is getting at. Because here's the thing. Skeptics are very inconvenient. They never ask questions at the convenient time. When you get asked difficult questions, big questions by your friends or by your family or by others, how often is it straight after, you know, you've just studied a subject or you've just read a great book and you have these 10 great points in order to answer their question and win them for Christ right there? It never happens that way. It always catches you off guard. It's always at a time that you don't expect. And what Peter is saying is this: look, you've got to expect, if you're going to live as someone who has Christ as Lord in their heart, that is going to be public and that is going to ask questions. Now, what we do know is those questions are going to come. What we don't know is when they're going to come. And so we have to be prepared. And the time, and that's a command. And the time of preparation is now. Now, that's where all the thinking and the studying and the doing mornings like this comes in order to help us get more prepared. And we are, some of us are more prepared than others, and that's absolutely fine. But we have to be in this continual process of getting more prepared. But here's the thing: prepared for what? Prepared to give a reason for the hope that it is within you. When I used to look at what John Lennox would do, I used to think I could never be prepared for that. But here's the thing. Richard Dawkins still hasn't called me and asked me to debate him yet. So I don't have to be prepared for debating Richard Dawkins. And I'm very thankful about that. I'm asked to be prepared to give a reason for the hope that is within me today, where I am. And God understands. And God will give me opportunities that are appropriate to that. Now, that doesn't mean I won't be stretched. But God will not expect you to give apologetic answers at a level that you simply don't have the capacity to give. Christian apologetics is you giving a reason for the hope within you. And the last two things, very quickly, and I'll hand over to Marie straight away after this, is this. Apologetics is about giving reason for hope. Not just about giving reason for ideas. It's about giving reason for the hope that we have. And so that, whatever what answers, whatever reasons we give, they ought to aim at hope. And the final thing that he says is, do it with gentleness and respect. The character of our doing apologetics has to be as Christian.